For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so the big picture with David, the epitaph of his life, a man after God's own heart. In later generations, when God talked about the kings of Israel, he always used David as the benchmark. Here was a guy whose heart was wholly mine. How about yours? And I just think that that is such an awesome and beautiful thing to consider here, that in David we have this example of what does a heart look like that's fully God's. And then in the light of that, probably the most disturbing passage in any biography anywhere in the Old Testament. Tonight we talk about the relationship between David and Bathsheba. And the focus is really on what David himself says in Psalm chapter 51, verse 10, where he talks about a broken and contrite heart. So let's pick up the narrative. Y'all know the story. I'm underlining little sections of it that we can kind of pull together at the end of the telling of the thing. But it goes like this. It says in chapter 11, verse 1, in the spring of the year, when kings normally go out to war, David sent Joab and the Israelite army to fight the Ammonites. They destroyed the Ammonite army and laid siege to the city of Rabbah. But David stayed behind in Jerusalem. Then it says, late in the afternoon after his midday nap, David got out of bed and was walking on his roof. And as he looked around over the city, he noticed a woman of unusual beauty taking a bath. So he sent someone to find out who she was. He was told she's Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam and wife of Uriah the Hittite. Then David sent for her, and when she came to his place, he slept with her. And later, Bathsheba sent word back to David saying, uh-oh, I'm pregnant. And so here we find ourselves in this predicament where David has pursued this woman, seduced her in his palace, which I guess would not be that difficult for a king to do, and then come to find out she's pregnant. Now, remember, David is a man after God's own heart, and so what would we think would a man after God's own heart do? Realizing, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. The reality of this, of my sin has crashed in on my head. I got to deal with this thing before the Lord. Is that what David does or not? It says, then David sent word to Joab. He's the general. And he said, send me Uriah the Hittite. So he did. And Uriah arrived, and David asked how the war was progressing. How's it going, Uriah? And Uriah said, then he told Uriah to go home and relax, put your feet up, get that relaxed feel, reintroduce yourself to your wife. And David even sent a gift to Uriah, but Uriah, it says, did not go home. Instead, he slept that night at the palace gate with the king's guard. What's David doing? He's thinking to himself, well, if Uriah just goes home and, you know, being on the battlefront all that time's lonely, and maybe he'll connect with Bathsheba, and this problem will all go away because, you know, who's the dad really anyway? There's no DNA testing available, nothing like that. But he's got a problem because Uriah is not the kind of guy who's going to do that. And it goes on and it says, when David heard that Uriah had not gone home, he summoned him. He says, what's the matter? Why did you not go home last night after being away for so long? And Uriah replied, look, the ark of the armies of Israel and Judah are living in tents, and Joab and my master's men are fighting in open fields. Think of the danger that my colleagues are in. How could I possibly go home to my wife? How could I go home to wine and dine and sleep with my wife? He says, I swear that I would never do such a thing. It would just be wrong to have my comforts at a time where everyone else that I care about is in peril. Well, David says, stay here today, here at the palace. And then David invited him to dinner and got him drunk. But even then, Uriah would not go home to his wife. Instead, again, he slept at the palace gate with the king's guard. And now David's realizing this guy is really hardcore. He's really all in, unlike me. And then it says the next morning that David instructed Joab. He's like, look, station Uriah in the front lines of battle and then pull back so that, you know, he's going to be isolated and the enemy will kill him. This is how we're going to deal with the problem of Uriah. So Uriah the Hittite was killed along with several other Israelite soldiers. Then the wife of Uriah, that's Bathsheba, heard that he was dead and she mourned for him. When the time of mourning was over, David sent for her and brought her into his house, and she bore his son. Wow, okay, so let's think about this. At the end of the narrative, our narrator says, the thing that David did was evil in the sight of the Lord. Really? Yeah. But that language is pretty interesting, that expression, evil in the sight of the Lord. It's used 60 times in the Old Testament, and it's used 40 times specifically as the phrase that the author of Kings uses to describe the moral condition and the relative success of the kings of Israel. And so most of the kings of Israel after David were real losers. They were duds. Their hearts were not fully God's, and the summary description that the prophet historian gives in Kings to all of these other kings that come from David's line, except for just a few, were that they did evil in the sight of the Lord. So it's not just some passing comment that our narrator here uses this expression. It really lumps David in with absolutely the worst that Israel has to offer. David did evil in the sight of the Lord. Now, what we want to do here is we want to understand the evil that David did just a little bit more. David, as a closer look at the narrative of his life would indicate, is really suffering from a slow leak. And that leak begins with what we'll call here serial adultery. And you'll note if you read through carefully both 1 and 2 Samuel, the story of David's life, you'll realize that at critical moments, David is picking up for himself more wives. And it says in 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 13, David, when he moved to Jerusalem, took on more wives and more concubines. And now he is really, he's just got a whole kind of harem thing going. And this is really a problem from God's perspective. It was common, of course, in the ancient world for a king to have many wives. And that would, in fact, be the expectation. You enter into marriage as a way to form alliances with other governments. Because you are the king, it is just expected that you be satisfying whatever your heart's desire is. That was the norm, but not the norm for God. And so we learn in Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 17, that God, anticipating the time when Israel will be led by kings, reminds the king, and he says, he shall not multiply wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away from God. So here's this warning. 400 years before the time of David, by Moses, saying, watch out. When you become king, you will fall under the same temptations as every other king, but God has called you to be different. To lead for him is to have a heart that's for him. And if your heart is spread out over all of these relationships with all of these women, you're not going to have room in your heart for God. And this was something that apparently David, over a period of years, had been involved with, and his heart was just kind of like that slow leak coming right out of that tire. We know, secondly, in the narrative that David was opting out of his duty. It makes it clear in chapter 11, verse 1. He says that in the spring of the year, when it's normal to go out and fight, David stayed home. You know, it was really more civil in the ancient world. There are battle seasons and non-battle seasons, apparently. Spring is a good time to fight. And so they get ready, they go out, they do their thing. But David, for the first time in the narrative of his life, decides, look, my feet are comfortable up on my ottoman. I like this new house that I've built for myself. I feel like the adversary is just not that challenging. Yeah, what does it matter, really? If I just stay home, I'll just entrust the whole thing to Joab. I'm sure he'll do a great job. And so it is that once David really comes into this successful moment of his life, begins to retreat a little bit back into what's comfortable for him, back into what's pleasing to him, and opting out of duties that have really defined David as the warrior king from the very beginning of our story. But now he's easing up. Now he's thinking about himself. Well, we move on, and clearly, you know, here's a guy who just like other kings, has decided that I should have. And so in the case of Bathsheba, it's like it doesn't matter whose wife this is. It's I'm interested. I'm stimulated. And so then why not? Why not just embrace what's going on in my heart? And then on top of adultery, betrayal and murder. We underlined in our reading of the narrative Uriah the Hittite. Uriah is an interesting person. Uriah, it says in 2 Samuel 23, these are the names of David's mighty men. There were 37 mighty men. These are people who are with David from the very beginning. These are people who put their life on the line to protect David, to go into battle with him. They fought all of the battles together. These were loyal men who would do anything to protect David and to further what God was doing through him. And Uriah was one of these guys, and it doesn't say Uriah the Judahite or Uriah the family member of David or whatever. It says Uriah the Hittite. Here's a guy who's not even a Hebrew. He's not a part of the covenant family of God, the Israelites. He becomes that way because he sees in Israel evidence of the one true living God. He wants to have a part in that. And so he becomes, as the Bible describes, the sojourner among us and one who has the opportunity to experience the hospitality of God's people and become a part of this project of God establishing a foothold in history through his people. And Uriah is one of these guys. And Uriah demonstrates an unusual kind of prowess in battle and deep commitment to David. So for David to take his wife, and then worse still, to have such blatant disregard for this honorable man, to murder him, is an extraordinary betrayal of everything that we know about David up to this point. It's incredible. And then the cynicism of this last piece, I think maybe in some ways the most disturbing part of this story is just the hypocrisy of the cover-up. At the end, it says that Bathsheba, after a time of mourning, is brought into David's household and is made his wife. She bears his son. David can congratulate himself and everyone else, saying, look what I've done to care for this poor widow who is the wife of my fallen comrade Uriah. Look at me caring, you know, for the well-being of those who are in my inner circle. Of course, no one knew that it was really his child whom she bore. And so just the hypocrisy of communicating that is just one of the worst pieces of this whole thing, because he sustains his image of this great king, this upright man, while all the while covering up for adultery, murder, all of the things that he has himself been guilty of. And it really raises, I think, some disturbing questions. Like, how is David really any different than Saul or anybody else? Saul was a pretty bad guy in a lot of ways, but you know what? There's not a single mention of Saul committing adultery or things along those lines. Saul was a what you see is what you get kind of guy. How is it that David could be called a man after God's own heart, doing this kind of stuff? And I think that this is pretty disturbing. I hope that you feel a sense that there's something very disturbing going on here. That this guy who we're called upon to look to as this picture of a unique man after God's own heart, one whose heart is wholly God's, a person who is worthy of us to imitate, is really, when you think about it, He is a lying, murderous adulterer. What is it about David that God finds attractive? Maybe God's standards are so low, the things that we're offended by, God's not. We need to get to the bottom of this. This is a very weird story. And a very strange legacy indeed. Well, let's read on. This is now in 2 Samuel chapter 12. Nathan has an interaction with David. And it says in verse 1 that the Lord sent Nathan to David, and he said this to him, David, I have an account of something going on in your kingdom that you would not believe, and I need your input. And it goes like this. There were two men in a city. One was rich, the other poor. The rich man had many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which he bought and nourished. It grew up with him and his family and ate his bread and drank from his cup and slept in his arms like a daughter. Now, a traveler came to the rich man. But he was unwilling to take a lamb from his own flock to prepare a meal for him. Instead, he took the poor man's ewe lamb and prepared that for the traveler. Okay, so in the ancient Near East, and Israel's part of this, hospitality is a very important value. When someone who's traveling comes to you, there is an obligation to care for their needs, to give them a place to stay and to feed them. And so that's what this story is really all about. But in this particular case, the guy who has all the herds finds that he's just too selfish to butcher his own sheep, and he takes this one sheep belonging to the guy who has but one sheep, this precious little lamb. And so it says that David's anger burned greatly against the man. And he said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, the man who did this deserves to die. Really feeling his moral outrage at this point, isn't he? He must make restitution fourfold because he had no compassion. And now, of course, God has David just exactly where he wants him. This outrage that David has felt toward this unjust, uncompassionate, rich man who takes the only precious thing that this poor man has. Yes, death. So cold. Well, Nathan responds and he says, "You are the man." Boom. Man, there's just nothing more powerful than working up a real moral lather over something and then realize I'm guilty of exactly the same thing. Has that ever happened in your life? It's happened in my life. That was one experience, in fact, that brought me into a relationship with Christ in the first place, realizing the disdain with which I held my own father. I was realizing as a young man, I'm no different than him. And it was humbling and humiliating to realize my own self-righteousness, my own contempt for someone who's no greater than they. You, David, are the one. All of your outrage ought to be directed toward yourself. And so he says, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, it is I who anointed you king over Israel. It is I who delivered you from Saul. It is I who gave your master's house." You see the pattern here? It is I who gave you Israel and Judah. Man, I've given you. What more can I give you? He goes on, he says, "I would have added to you many more things like these, David. What did I hold back from you that you felt like you had to have more? Why have you despised the word of the Lord by doing evil in his sight?" And now it says, David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." And so David now for the second time has an opportunity to really think seriously about what does this mean. When he found out that Bathsheba was pregnant, he had a moment, he had an opportunity. What could he have done? He could have said, "Wow, I can't believe I did this. I need to bring Uriah back home. I need to confess this to him to make restitution for my wrongdoing. And to just deeply apologize." But no, he covers it up. So here's now a second opportunity to get it right with Nathan confronting him as he does in this way. And finally, David says, agrees, and he says, "Yes, I have sinned against the Lord." There's no hiding behind some excuse, some flimsy tale or whatever. "I am guilty. I have sinned against the Lord." And then Nathan replied, "The Lord has taken away your sin." Just like that? Yeah. Yeah, just like that. And so here then lies a second fairly stunning, disconcerting part of our narrative. It is, if it's not disconcerting enough, that this man that we are called to emulate has this deep flaw. I mean, I've had problems in my life. You have too. I've never been tempted to murder to cover it up. Just saying. And yet here's this guy we're supposed to imitate. And then for God, really? Just because David says, "I've sinned against the Lord," Nathan's like, "Oh, well, the Lord has taken away your sin." Just like that? Just like that. That's a little disturbing too. We need to dig just a little deeper to figure out what is it that's really going on in this story that was so important to God that he wanted to make sure that we understood what's really at stake with this whole situation here and why David remains this man after his own heart. Let's take a look at David's own reflections on this event in Psalm chapter 51. Psalm 51 and Psalm 32 are specifically written by David in response to this confrontation that David brings to him over the incident with Bathsheba and Uriah. I want to just break it down a little bit for you here and draw some lessons from it. It begins with what's called a superscription, like a description of the context of the psalm. And this is from David. It says, a psalm of David when Nathan the prophet came to him after he sinned against Bathsheba. So that sets the context. We know exactly what this is about. We want to know what's in the heart of David, what's really going on in this narrative. Well, here's what happens. When David says, I've sinned against God, that's short for something much deeper going on in his heart. And it says in verse 1, be gracious to me, God, according to your loving kindness, according to the greatness of your compassion, blot out my sin. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. And so, David, in his exchange with God, who is he addressing? He's not talking to Nathan. He's not talking to Bathsheba, the one that he sinned against. He's not talking to anyone but God. That's the audience of one. The only one whose opinion at this point really matters is God's. And so there's a direct kind of exchange right here. And what is he doing? He's making an appeal. He's pleading with God. He's asking specifically, be gracious to me, to wash me. Grace means an unmerited favor. An unmerited acceptance. It's this basic principle that says that human beings who are broken and who are far from God and who are sinful can never, by their own works, do what God requires. We're never going to be like God. We'll never be acceptable because it's too late. I'm sorry if you're here tonight. It's way too late for you. If there is going to be anything that binds you together with a holy God, it's going to be something that God grants to you as favor, as a gift that you do not deserve. And so David is calling out and he's saying, I want in on that. I want a standing with you, God, that is not based upon what I do for you, but on what you have done for me. And then he says, wash me. And I think that there, yeah, that's an apt description. When you are really aware of the depths of your own brokenness, your own depravity, your own failings, I think the feeling is just like, you know, I feel slimed by myself. Feel like I'd love to take a shower and just wash all this stuff off. You know how that feels? And David's like, wash me thoroughly, cleanse me from my sin. Help get this stuff off of me. And this is not just an empty request, but it's a request that's rooted in something real about God. He says, be gracious according to your loving kindness. According to your compassion. And so what David is doing is he's bringing his own interaction with God right back to that place in Exodus 34, verse 6, where God says, this is who I am, the Lord, the compassionate, abounding in loving kindness. He's bringing this out and he's saying, I know who you are. And when it says that you abound in loving kindness, that means that even me, even someone like me can fall in the framework of your compassion. That your abounding loving kindness, your hesed, your loyalty, your covenant love is abounding so much that yes, even this terrible thing that I've done, all of the things that surround this incredibly painful and terrible event with Bathsheba and Uriah. Even that, yes, your loving kindness is greater than that. This is what David is affirming. And this is what we need to understand here tonight. Okay, so you're here and you look back at your life and you realize, man, I have blown it so bad. I don't know anybody who trusts me. I don't trust myself. I'm really broken. There's something really wrong with me. Tragically unacceptable about who I am. And God's like, yeah, that's right. If what you're bringing to the table is your own credentials, that's where you're going to be. But I got some different credentials for you, which is my great love for you, my graciousness for you, because that is the heart of God. His abounding loving kindness. There's nothing that you do to merit the acceptance of God, and neither is there anything you can do to bring yourself outside the circle of his love and of his care. Do you know that? Do you believe that? There's nothing that you bring to the table that merits your acceptance, and therefore there's nothing that you can do to take you outside of God's realm of concern for you. That is a profound reality. If our acceptability isn't based upon ourselves but upon God, there's nothing that we can do other than simply to appeal to who he is. And this is what David does. That's pretty good news for a guy like David who realizes just how far he's fallen. He says in verse 3, I know my transgressions and my sin is ever before me. And against you alone I have sinned and done what is evil in your sight so that you're blameless when you judge. It's an interesting part. It's confession. And he says, he's not making excuses, is he? He's not saying, well, look, man, surely you understand. You created man and you created testosterone. And you created sexual drives, and I was up there on the roof, and who could resist a Bathsheba naked in front of me? No. I know my transgression. My sin is ever before me. I have no one to blame but myself. Folks, people have sinned against you plenty in your life. I know that. A lot of us really experience the are left with the scars of living in a world where we've not been treated well, perhaps. Some really deep wounds have come into our lives. That's really tragic. But the real things that we need to be concerned with are what have I done in response to those things? What about my side? How have I responded in bitterness, in anger, in judgment? In a total shutdown lack of love, of self-protection, where I don't feel any obligation to anyone or anyone to me. And that's sin. That's wrong. And if we want to find God's way, we find God's way not by wallowing in the world of offenses done to us, but by recognizing what is it that on my side of the table that I need to own. I know my transgression and my sin is ever before me. Then in verse 4 he says, against you alone have I sinned. Well, I think Bathsheba may have a different opinion of that. And Uriah for sure. But what David is saying here is not that he didn't sin against them, but that the core of his offense is an offense towards God. And I do feel like there is something important in this in the sense that we tend to think on a very horizontal plane in terms of our moral conduct. Yeah, I blew it. I was wrong. I'm sorry. Forgive me. Okay, that's important to do. But there's something even more fundamental than healing a broken relationship that we break through our sin against another person. And that's to realize that my offenses towards others are offenses toward God. God is the moral lawgiver. It's his law that I have violated. It's going my own way, not his way, that is the source of these things that I have done to myself and to others. And it is therefore to God that I need to make my peace. There has to be reconciliation with God before there will ever be real peace with anybody else. I've got to deal with God. When I have a problem with my wife, with one of my children, with a friend, I need to own my part in that. But I also need to be asking this question, what's going on between myself and God? What is it about God that I'm not believing and that I'm not trusting and that I'm just disregarding for the sake of my own self? And that if I don't go back to that place, then all of my relationships with people end up being negotiations, right? I'll meet you halfway. I won't sin against you if you won't sin against me, things like that. And we've got to understand that the core of the thing is getting it right with God. And that's what David comes back to here. Let's move on. He says, moving forward, I was born in iniquity and sin in my and in sin my mother conceived me. But you desire truth in the innermost being, and in the hidden parts you will make known wisdom. Let the bones you broke rejoice. This is a fascinating little piece right here. What's he talking about? He's really getting into the truth of the matter. You desire truth, he says, in the inner person. It brings us back to an earlier reflection of David on this event in Psalm 32, where he talks about this condition that we find ourselves in when we are suppressing what we know to be true, when we are trying to lie to ourselves to justify what's really going on in our hearts. David said about this event, when I kept silent, and you know, he went for over a year, it would seem, from the narrative of 2 Samuel, for a year at least, keeping a lid on this thing, deceiving everybody, of course not Bathsheba, but everybody else knew. Maybe Bathsheba didn't really understand that David was her husband's murderer. David is juggling a lot of stuff, isn't he? And he's suppressing it. And he says, when I kept silent about my sin, my body wasted away. I groaned all day long. Day and night, your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was drained away. Have you ever felt like that before? Just carrying about in your heart the sheer weight of your failure. This is a picture from the book that we read to our children probably in the hundreds of times, Dangerous Journey, which is a children's adaptation of A Pilgrim's Progress. And it begins with this man named Christian, who comes to recognize the burdensome load on his back, which is the sum of all of his attitudes of the heart, the things that he did that he shouldn't have, the things that he didn't do that he should have, just the disposition of his heart that made it a heavy load. And he's on his way to taking that heavy load to the cross. My friends, I think a lot of us here tonight are carrying a heavy load. Like David, find our vitality drained. Find ourselves just awash in cynicism. Maybe by chemical disposition, we have a propensity to depression, but that doesn't explain this kind of depression, this kind of weight that I feel in my heart. We feel so distant and therefore so lonely because we can't move towards other people because we're carrying this baggage of expectations, of broken relationships from our past. And in that sense, just like David says, it's like our bones are broken. We hurt. We know we're broken. And I want to appeal to you here tonight, if you can in any way identify with what David is describing here, to maybe take a different kind of look at the things that you find that you're struggling with here tonight. I don't for a minute want to suggest that your problems are only moral and spiritual, that there are not maybe biochemical things or things in your past experience or whatever those things might be for you. But I will suggest at the same time that you are never far from the reality of what David is describing here. That there is a weight that comes from our own brokenness and from what we've done to ourselves. And that we bear that weight, that burden. And within ourselves, so many of us here tonight feel that we want to be free. We want to maybe go back to a time in our life where we didn't feel like this, where we felt like we could move freely and we could run. But now, today, it's just not like that for us. And there's that burdensome weight. And David's like, you know what? That is an important warning call. When you begin to really come to in touch with that weight that you feel, that no therapy, no regimen of medicine, nothing can ever lift apparently in your life. Maybe there's another thing. Maybe it's time to orient ourselves to this fact that our thinking and our whole orientation toward the problems in our life are not what God wants, that there's a truth in the inner person that God desires. We need to learn to agree with Him. And where we find that we are able to agree with Him about where we are far from Him and where we are broken, then there's a possibility of real change. And that real change then is coming shortly. Okay. Now, if we're at that place where we're carrying that load, then we can call out to God as David does. And he says three things. Create in me a clean heart, O God. Do not, secondly, cast me away from your presence or remove your Holy Spirit from me. And thirdly, restore to me a joy, the joy of your salvation, which then leads me to teach others who are like me your ways. This is what it means when we come to that place where we've got the burden, we're trying to rid ourselves of this deep burden. We call out to God for restoration. Create a clean heart in me. I don't want a left 2.0. You know, a restart for the person that I am. A restart for the person that I am is a bad place to start because it's going to lead to exactly the same place. And the really sweet thing that David understands, and which is the hope of the prophets of the Old Testament, Jeremiah 31 and others like that, is what Jesus himself offers, which is a new creation. Not to be better, but to be born again. Not better, new, with the indwelling presence of God's Spirit within us, we become a new creation. There are new desires, new passions that well up within us when we have the heart of God resident within us. That's what God is offering to us. Not merely that we're forgiven, but that we can be made new in Him by the asking. The good news about Jesus Christ is not merely that we can be made right with God, but that being made right with God, then we can come into a relationship with Him that is so intimate that His own Spirit comes to reside within us. We are made new. Made new. Don't cast me from your presence, he says, or remove your Spirit from me. To be in the presence of God, this is what he desires. And then lastly, he says, restore to me a joy. That lightness that comes when my burden is off. When I realize that it's not just that I'm trying harder or have a second chance, but that I'm a new creation. And that kind of restoration, which has nothing to do with me and everything to do with God, which is a supernatural work of God to create a heart that was just a stone dead thing and now has become alive. That is awesome. That produces joy. And that's something worth telling people about. Because we got a whole world of people who are trying to make themselves 2.0. And how's that going? Not well. How about 3.0? Not so good. How about 4.0? And revision after revision after revision is leading us nowhere. Because it's not getting to the source of the thing, which is who am I? And God's got a solution for that. And that's good news. Now, lastly, he says in verse 16, you do not delight in sacrifice, otherwise I would give it. You're not pleased with burnt offerings, otherwise I'd give them. What's he saying? There's no religious way out of this. The sacrifice, he says, that you desire is a broken spirit. You will not reject a broken and repentant heart, O God. And that's really what this is all about. We come to the finish line. We think about the heart of grace. It's the heart of repentance. That's really what we think about David. What have we met with? A man after God's own heart. That's what. Not less sinful, but ready to turn to God. That's what we learn about David. He's not some paragon of virtue. I think on the level of his behavior, God would be like, no, no, don't go there. But on the level of what is going on in his heart before God, yes. Perfectly? No. But truly, genuinely, here is a guy who repeatedly makes mistakes and repeatedly turns back to God. Remember way back in 1 Samuel chapter 25, the interactions with Abigail after David is so offended and inflamed that he's going to go and he's going to murder this guy Nabal and his entire family for being snubbed because he wouldn't share his food. So he's going to be the judge, jury, and executioner. And Abigail's like, no, don't do that. And because your soul cannot bear the weight of this terrible sin. I love the way the NLT translates that verse. Your soul cannot bear the weight of this terrible sin. And he's like, oh, thank you for bringing this to my attention. You're right. I had murder in my heart, and that's what I was going to do, and you've brought me back. Thank you. See, David wasn't a great man in the sense that he was sinless. He was a great man in that he was in tune with his heart enough that at the end of the day, he knew how to turn to God. He knew how to change his mind about where he's been at. That's what repentance is. And so we just leave you with this. What is God looking for from you? You're broken just like I am. We all are. And what does it mean then to have the truth of God penetrate into that inner person and to turn from that so that we can experience the vitality of new life that God has for us. And in this way, you know, David is a man for the ages. He's an example for you and me about the fact is he's not having to just beat himself up, offer his religious justifications for his behavior and religious solutions to his guilt, but just to surrender himself to agree with God, to receive something that's not deserved, and then to just have that real intimate connection reestablished with the Lord. That's what he wants for you.
This study was recorded at Zenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.